I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, April 29th, episode 86 of Pandemic. Today's focus is on India, which is currently going through a shocking crisis. Countries around the world are responding to appeals from India for oxygen as people queue in the street for beds outside hospitals that are in many cases unable to help them. The country has seen over 207,000 people die, and in the last 24 hours alone, India's cases at over 390,000 made up over 40% of the entire global case increase. The country also accounted for a quarter of global deaths in the last 24 hours, with over 3,500 people dying. Nilanjana Bhoumik recently wrote a comprehensive account in the National Geographic of the scale of the crisis this wave of the pandemic is causing for her country. And in the following interview, she gives me the overview of what the country is going through and tells me about how her own family and indeed how she has been affected. That's up next. Okay, so Nilanjana Bhoumik, welcome to the Pandemic Podcast for RTE. Thanks very much for making the time to talk to us. And I'm sure what's quite a busy time for a journalist working in India whose beat covers health and science and the like.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, you know, it is busy, but you know, it's not the right kind of busy, unfortunately.
Can we just go back to the beginning? Because at the start, the big fear about India was that some of the crowded slums in the city would be very vulnerable to COVID. And then when migrant workers went back to their home places, it was thought too that COVID would rip through India and it would be extremely vulnerable. What was the experience?
I mean, it was, you know, at that time last year when the pandemic had erupted, our first concern was for, you know, journalists like myself who work extensively in rural areas. Our first concern was that, you know, it's going to rip through rural India, especially because, A, you know, a majority of people live in rural India. 2/3 of India, you know, live in rural India. Public health structure is in shambles. I mean, it's in shambles all over the country, but, you know, at least in the cities and towns, you have private hospitals. But in the villages, often, you know, there are just medical centers, primary medical centers, or, you know, then there would be like one big district hospital. So the infrastructure was not there. And of course, you know, this was the first time, I'm talking about last year now, this is the first time, you know, like this virus had just burst, you know, like into our lives, and nobody knew, you know, what it could do, how it would progress. So there was a lot of uncertainty at that point of time, and we were basically trying to look at everything that could go wrong. Fortunately, we escaped with a very moderate wave. I mean, when the migrants went back home, yes, there were, you know, like spikes in cases and all, but they were all manageable. Probably because, you know, there was a lot of fear last year. Because as I said, you know, we didn't know what this virus was all about. We didn't know how it was progressing, you know, like where it would go, what kind of a crisis, you know, we would have. And all over the world, I think people were just looking at India because everyone thought that, you know, it was a disaster waiting to happen. And that didn't happen because, you know, we were careful. We did the best we could. Absolutely, you know, we did the absolute best that we could do.
And in some cases, the best that India could do was very good. Local authorities, I think in one slum, Dharavi, Mumbai, really kept case numbers very low. There were food deliveries, there was regular testing, there was great monitoring. I was reading a study of it. I was actually interested in talking to the professor who had authored it about last month, because at that stage, before the current wave, it looked like that kind of very localized methodology in India had really worked and had spared India the worst of us before, obviously, we hit the current wave.
Yes, I mean, you know, first of all, you know, we pulled, you know, are like almost 2.5 million community health workers who generally, you know, work in rural areas, you know, with children's vaccination and women's health, known as ASHAs. And we pulled them into, you know, contact tracing and, you know, going into villages and sort of, you know, just monitoring the situation. That worked really well. And then, you know, as you said, you know, there were a lot of, you know, like localized attempts to contain the virus. Dharavi is like a huge, you know, like great big example of, you know, how, you know, like such a congested, like a slum area, you know, it actually, you know, like everybody's feared that the urban slums could become hotspots. It didn't happen. Last year, the infections were mostly contained in high rises and, you know, like city areas, you know, among, you know, people, you know, the well-heeled mostly. So, and also, you know, there were so many of these events that happened, you know, we had such big protests, you know, I mean, the farmers protest, for example, I wrote a piece about it, you know, like looking into, you know, why, you know, it did not become a super spreader, even because that's what everybody feared, because there were like hundreds of thousands of, you know, like farmers, you know, gathering, you know, outside the borders of the Indian capital. At that point of time, I spoke to a lot of experts and we were just trying to basically figure out like why, you know, and they told me that not a single case of the virus, you know, had been identified, although, you know, there were like people like literally like just, you know, overflowing with people. I went to report there for a story and they actually don't let you wear a mask. So if you are trying to interview them, they'll say, you know, take off your mask. And in the beginning, I was really worried. But, you know, I had to do the job and nothing happened. I was really, you know, worried. And I came back home and I isolated myself because I live with my my parents and my son. But nothing happened, you know, nothing at all. This time around, you know, I had been at home because I have been on a sabbatical. And I was infected. I think my mother was infected before me and she passed it on to the rest of us. And we all tested positive on April 15th. And I haven't even been out anywhere, you know, reporting or anywhere. So there's a really a huge difference between how the virus, you know, progressed last year and how, you know, like it's progressing this year.
And what happened between the two waves? I mean, I, from what you're saying, when India, there was a huge amount of fear as to how it would affect India, both rural and urban. And then when that nightmare scenario didn't come to pass, and even when there were potential super spreader events that again didn't turn into being super spreader events, was there an element of a false sense of security? Did, as I think the health minister had said, did people feel that the virus or the era of the virus was over, especially as India has the Serum Institute there and could possibly think that at least the vaccine was on the way?
We did nothing. In the interim period, we did nothing. There was a lot of overconfidence. The messaging that went out from our leaders were totally, absolutely wrong. There was no science behind anything. You know, we should have really used the interim period to boost our capabilities, to boost our health infrastructure, or at least to maintain or retain what we had built last year, like the COVID centers and, you know, all the quarantine centers in villages, you know, because the migrant population were coming back. So last year what happened was that every village would have a quarantine center where they would be isolated for 15 days. And then after that, they would be allowed to go home. Yesterday, I was speaking to some ASHA workers in, you know, villages in Maharashtra and Uttar Pradesh. And they told me that those quarantine centers are not there. So people are coming back from the cities and they're going straight home and they're infecting their family members. And then they're also hiding it from the ASHA workers because, of course, you know, the ASHA workers are the eyes on the ground. So that's one thing, of course, you know, we should have retained, you know, or maintained the facilities that we had built. So I understand part of that is also because our health system is so inadequate that to keep, you know, this facilities, this COVID facilities to divert, you know, like resources to keep running COVID facilities when there were the cases were plummeting quite noticeably. People were talking about India approaching herd immunity. But at the same time, you know, we should have taken a lesson from what was happening in the rest of the world. Other countries were already in the grips of, you know, very bad second and third waves. And our domestic experts were also warning of a worse second wave. But, you know, those were dismissed as negative sentiments. I went to Kolkata, you know, like Calcutta a while back. And while I was there, I was reporting a story. And everyone I would talk to, they would say, where is Corona? You know, it's gone. It was never there. Or, you know, like it was like just it's just flu. So, the messaging from our government, the messaging should have stayed. The messaging should have been that, you know, this can come back. Be careful. Stay at home. Wear your masks. Yes, you know, we are doing well now, but this can come back. But what did our government do? You know, they didn't do that. They started, you know, having all this, you know, like election rallies. Our ministers were our top ministers, home minister, prime minister. They were zipping around the country, attending huge rallies. As you mentioned, our health minister, he's a physician. He said in March that we are in the end game of the pandemic. How? I mean, he's a physician. He's a man of science. I mean, the science of the infection doesn't say that. The science of the infection says that unless the world is vaccinated, no country is safe. And also, you know, it was in January, we had already identified two new variants. The UK variant was like wreaking havoc in the northern state of Punjab. And in Maharashtra, we have had our own homegrown variant, the B1617.
And do we know what kind of a role they have been playing? I mean, you mentioned obviously those large public gatherings, and we saw the Kumbh Mela festival as well, where people were, you know, millions of people bathing in the Ganges River. Is it those kind of events, or is it the variants, or is it both, that it's just the perfect storm? Do we know yet?
It's a mix of everything. I mean, you cannot pinpoint the second wave to anyone, because, you know, India is a large country, and, you know, there will be, you know, like a large number of variants, mutants. There will be. It's a given. I was speaking to one expert recently, and he said very rightly that, you know, one epidemic in India is actually multiple epidemics. It's actually, and you need to have multiple strategies to handle this epidemic. So what should have been done is that, like today, you know, we have this shortage of oxygen and hospital beds. It's because the infection is spreading uncontrolled. It's like spreading like wildfire. It's gone out of our hands now. But, you know, when these new variants were being identified in Punjab or in Maharashtra, our resources could have been, you know, whatever resources we had, we could have moved it there. We could have, you know, like contained the spread, you know, in those states. It didn't happen, obviously, because, you know, we also opened up. So people were traveling between states. People coming from abroad as well. Our strategies were very wrong. We were looking at the short term. We were looking at the falling numbers. We were willing the pandemic to pass, which is understandable. All over the world, I'm sure everybody wants the pandemic to pass. But you cannot do that at the cost of science. You cannot do that, you know, at the cost of people's lives. And to get back to your question about the Kumbh Mela started on April 1st. So we will see its effects, you know, probably in the coming weeks. Of course, you know, there were a lot of, you know, like COVID positive, you know, cases that were identified there. But those people must have already been carrying the virus when they had reached there. And there they must have infected a lot more people. And those people will be going back home. It's just going to prolong the crisis. Like, of course, you know, the second wave had to come. It couldn't be prevented, but it could have been contained. Which, you know, all these events, you know, the election rallies and campaigning and the Kumbh Mela, weddings. The government allowed 200 guests in weddings. And, you know, weddings mostly happen in close spaces. So all of this, you know, they are just going to prolong the crisis.
Right. And I mean, the numbers such as they are at the moment, I mean, there's in excess of, I think it's 204,000 deaths at the moment around, and case rates are up at 380,000 almost per day. As against that, I think India has distributed almost or administered about 150 million vaccines. But as you said yourself, it's a big country with a huge population. Even with that effort, it's very difficult to make a dent in the spread of the virus. What's the vaccination infrastructure like, and what's the supply like? given India's, you know, domestic pharmaceutical sector, which is kind of world famous. How is that tying in with the local public health effort to get people vaccinated, and how is that prioritized?
I think the, you know, our reputation as the pharmacy of the world set us back quite a bit, in the sense that, you know, we thought that, you know, we would be okay. And we would have been okay if, you know, like this thing hadn't erupted suddenly. We were close to other vaccines, you know, we only had two vaccines available to us. The pace of the vaccination, you know, the aim was great. The pace was fine in the beginning, you know. First of all, you know, the health workers were vaccinated, and then the senior citizens and people with comorbidities. But then, you know, as what happened was that we also started exporting vaccines, because I think, you know, the main thing was that the cases started falling. And as I said, that nobody thought to pay any heed to, you know, epidemiologists, you know, experts, you know, warning of second wave. So I think till date we have exported around 193 million doses of our vaccines, and those could have come in really handy right at the moment, because there are vaccine shortages. People are going to vaccine centers and they're being turned away. A lot of people who didn't take the vaccine owing to vaccine hesitancy are now going and they're not getting the vaccine anymore. People, you know, who have taken the first dose, the dose, and they're not getting the second dose. So there's a lot of, you know, vaccine shortages, and hopefully the government has taken steps to ramp up production, and, you know, other vaccines will be available soon. So we can only hope at this point of time that people will get vaccinated, but it will take time. And I don't know, you know, whether we have so much time, because the coming 2 weeks are crucial. You know, that's when, you know, we would need to sort of clamp down on the infection, and we can do that, you know. If there has to be, everything has to be ramped up. Our hospitals, you know, access to medicines and oxygen and medical resources, basically. So the coming 2 weeks will give us an idea as to like where this is going. Right now, everything is a confusion at the moment.
The export of oxygen to India has become a worldwide effort, and in some ways the sheer scale of the problem in India has even managed to change to a certain degree the thinking in the United States about export of vital ingredients for vaccines. But you quoted in your recent article in National Geographic, which is well worth a read, and we must tweet out a link to it with this podcast as well. But in January you said the export of oxygen from India went up by 734%. As a European, I suppose, you can feel a certain sympathy that India played ball with the international export game, but the public feeling about that must be quite negative at the moment.
So, the government said later on after that, that story was broken by, you know, an Indian television channel. And the government came back later to say that, you know, that's not medical use oxygen, that's industrial oxygen, or, you know, like all of it taken together.
Right.
It was not just medical oxygen. So now, of course, you know, there's a lot of effort by the government to damage control. But the point is that at the end of the day, you know, for layperson, how does it really matter? You know, he or she is seeing a loved one gasping for breath, not getting an oxygen. They're running helter-skelter from pillar to post, you know, trying to arrange for oxygen. And then, you know, you see this kind of figures and it makes you mad. You know, you really do not want to get into, you know, what sort of oxygen was being exported. You just think that in a country of, you know, over 1.5 billion people with a pandemic that is uncertain, that is deadly, that has sort of, you know, ripped through the entire world, how could you even take such a decision? The pandemic was not over, right? The WHO did not say that the pandemic was over. It was not announced that the pandemic is over. So how could you take a decision like that? You know, you should have, you know, in a country like ours, you know, with so many, you know, like with such a huge population, our first instinct would have been to conserve our resources, because we don't have too much of it. we have a lot of people and we do not have too much resources. So our effort should have been, you know, instead of, you know, trying to, you know, our prime minister was, of course, you know, trying to improve his international image. I'm all for international cooperation. But the point is that when you have so many people, you know, who have access to such little resources, we should have conserved, you know, we should have, you know, prepared for a second wave.
You mentioned there a couple of times in the course of this interview the state of the public health service and the divisions between public and private, which, you know, is a thing that's probably replicated in an awful lot of countries, not least Ireland, where there's a mix of public and private. But how does that break down in terms of people's access to healthcare? Because one of the features that we've seen in India, and something you've reported on yourself, is people resorting to social media to plead for resources that they couldn't access through the health service. So how has that been, and how have people with very little income been able to access public health services, if at all?
So this, you know, the second wave has literally just erased the differences between the public healthcare system and the private healthcare system. Even in private hospitals, you are not, you know, like, there are no beds, no oxygen. And I mean, you cannot even, of course, you know, when this crisis started, the first thing that we immediately knew was that you cannot even access anything in the public healthcare system. So you had to, people who have money will try and access the private healthcare system. But the private healthcare system also is reeling under this crisis. So there are no beds. But then again, there is a, you know, there has been, people have been profiting, you know, from this misfortune, this crisis. So people have been hoarding oxygen in the private sector, you know. I mean, there are anecdotal evidence of hospitals holding on to beds, private hospitals holding on to beds and, you know, giving them to the highest bidder, if you know what I mean. So someone just told me, just yesterday, someone told me that one of their family members, you know, was very ill, and they are quite well to do. So when they were taken to the hospital, they said that, you know, they asked 1.5 lakhs rupees, you know, like for a bed, which would be around, I guess, around $2,000 or something. So they were well healed, so they could give them that money. But, you know, for most people, I'm not even talking about the poor. I think the poor has just sort of given up. In my conversations with, you know, the underprivileged part of a population, they just say, there's nothing we can do. If you can't access, if you people can't access, you know, hospital beds and oxygen, what hope is there for us? We'll stay at home. Will, you know, get better or not get better? You know, this is how this is what we are used to. You know, this system, this country system don't work for us. So we are used to it. And that is true, you know, absolutely true. Today, you know, this thing has been highlighted because everyone has been affected. But the poor has been, you know, most of the times, you know, in our country, the poor has only access to the public healthcare system. And, you know, they die preventable deaths all the time. So for them, you know, they have just given up. So and the rest of the population, you know, is like a friend of mine. She bought an oxygen cylinder for 35,000 rupees. And another friend, you know, his wife was taken very ill a couple of days back. And we were desperately trying to find them some oxygen. And we went to the same guy who had sold that oxygen cylinder for 35,000 rupees. And that point of time, he was asking for 1.6 lakhs, which is again in around $2,000. And so people are, you know, in the private sector, that is also happening. And that is what is adding to the panic.
Do you think there'll be a political effect of this? I mean, the handling of it and what you say about people, even the well-heeled, being affected by it. Because I think in a lot of political crises, it's not really until the middle class and more well-to-do people really feel the pinch that you see upheaval or fundamental political change. Is there any sense of that? Is there any group within politics in India who advocated or advised a different course, who are now being seen as a more responsible political party? Or are people pretty much sticking to their usual political loyalties? Or maybe it's just too early to tell at this stage.
All of those things, actually. I mean, the Congress Party, which is in opposition at the moment, their leader, Rahul Gandhi, had been warning about this pandemic right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, you know, when the government was taking it too lightly, they were saying that, you know, I'm talking about last year, that this is not going to affect India. And then, you know, and he has been constantly trying to raise, awareness about this. And he's generally, you know, like just made fun of and just, you know, that's how, you know, our current, you know, ruling party deals with opposition. There is no healthy debate. There is no engagement. It's either, you know, trolling or, you know, like that kind of stuff, you know, where there is no place for debate or dissent in dissent in this country at this moment. So yes, you know, he has been, you know, trying to raise awareness about this, warning the government for a very long time, and he was not taken seriously. Even before the second wave, you know, he has sent out quite a lot of warnings that it was not taken seriously. And his party has been, you know, quite at the forefront, you know, helping people. And he has, his image has definitely improved ever since, you know, this, we fell into this crisis. So people are now taking him much more serious. Then right at this moment, you know, everybody is like in deep, deep distress. Like, there is a lot of anger against Mr. Modi, against, you know, his ministers at the moment. But then people are too distressed. Everybody has lost someone, friend, acquaintance, family members. The stories, you know, just keep coming in, and it's exhausting. I don't think people are thinking in terms of politics at all at this moment. But yes, this will have a long-term effect on Mr. Modi's future. And one can only hope that people will ask for accountability. That is what is most important, because in our country, we don't ask for accountability. Governments come and go, they mistreat, you know, like the population, whichever way they want to. They play us in whichever way they want to. And we rarely ever ask for accountability. So I really hope that once we are out of this crisis, that we would be in a position to ask for accountability and work on our anger.
Can I ask you then finally about your own personal experience of this? You mentioned that your family had become affected, and you said that most people had lost somebody during the pandemic. I mean, as you've been reporting on this, you've also been experiencing it. So what has that been like for you?
In the beginning, it was actually quite unbelievable. I mean, of course, you know, I have been, you know, tracking events and monitoring, you know, like what's happening. But, you know, when we all tested positive, my first worry was, was that, you know, my parents were here with me. But they had taken the first dose of the vaccine. So their infections were pretty mild. So in the beginning, I thought that, you know, we would be okay. And then my father's oxygen levels started dropping. And that was when, you know, I mean, as I said right in the beginning, that I work with underprivileged people a lot. I work in rural areas a lot. So, you know, it doesn't come as a surprise to me. You know, I know that our healthcare system is very, very compromised. And of course, you know, we live in the cities and we go to the, to private hospitals. And that's very expensive. You know, not a lot of people can, you know, afford private healthcare in India. So in the beginning, I had thought that, okay, fine, you know, I mean, like if there's an emergency, I can take my father to a private hospital. And I mean, that's exactly why I have an insurance. Then I realized, because, you know, when we tested positive, the crisis had just like began. Like this is like 15th of April. And then I suddenly realized that, because I was talking to my GP and she said that, you know, you need to take him to a hospital. And I said that, can I bring him to your hospital? She's like, no, we have been overbooked, you know, for a week almost. So you need to, you know, like find this hospital. And she just, you know, like gave me some names and I started just calling them. And that's when, you know, it hit me that, you know, it was unreal, you know, like I kept calling a hospital after hospital. Some wouldn't pick up, you know, some would just pick the helplines, you know, like they would pick up and then they'll just put down the phone. And the hospitals, you know, had no beds at all. I told my mother that we'll have to, if there's an emergency, we'll have to deal with it at that point of time. I was pretty fortunate, or maybe my father was pretty fortunate, that, you know, we got hold of a very caring doctor, and she really handheld us, you know, throughout the process, and she put him on medicines, and she said that we need a hospital bed, but I mean, I know how difficult it is at the moment. So, you know, we just literally just, I just crossed my fingers and said, and hoped that he would respond to the medicines, because I actually didn't know what we would do if that didn't happen, because I had no alternative arrangement. I had tried, you know, I had tried, my friends had tried, but we couldn't do anything. So, you know, as I said, you know, fortunately for him, he responded to the medicines, and still, you know, it's like, you know, he has good days and bad days, and, you know, but that initial crisis, you know, at that point of time, that is not there anymore. And but as I said, that, you know, if that crisis had continued, and I had written in my piece, you must have read that, you know, I actually had to, ever since we tested positive, you know, I haven't had heard from any health worker. So nobody has called to ask, you know, how we are managing. And I had a very bad infection, because, you know, I didn't have access to the vaccine, because I'm not 45 as yet. So I had a very bad infection. I literally, like, even now I cannot, like, type for too long or sit up or walk for too long. But I had to actually haul him. My father can't walk. He's a Parkinson's patient. So I had to haul him in a wheelchair, take him to a COVID hospital, and, you know, get the scan done. It when I look back, it kind of feels like it happened to somebody else, but I know it happened to me, and I know it's happening to almost every other person out there. You know, it's so scary, and I think, you know, at this moment in time, every time my phone rings, I know it's a friend or someone I know just calling to tell me that, you know, they've tested positive, and, you know, I'm just going to be, we are just paying it forward, you know, I'm just going to be forwarding them all the lists that I had compiled, doctors and everything, and resources. I'll give it to them and just, you know, cross my fingers again and hope that, you know, everything goes well.
Neelanjana, thanks very much for spending the time and talking to us. I hope your father and yourself and your family recover well and get through this. The very best of luck. I hope it goes well for you and indeed for
your country. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And that's it for another episode. If you want to give us any feedback or get in touch, you can contact me on colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie, or on Twitter @colmomongain. Do feel free to give us a good rating on your podcast platform of choice, or leave a nice review, or even recommend us to a friend. Now, we won't have an episode next week, but I'll be back the week after that with more. Until then, take care, stay safe, and thanks for listening.